Coming up in the second hour of Midday, one of the great figures from the American Western frontier, Wyatt Earp. A new biography separates the myth from the real man, and the portrait is not as glowing as we've been led to believe. Historian Andrew Eisenberg on Wyatt Earp, lawman and lawbreaker of the Wild West, when Midday continues after the news at 1.
And bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told.
Between 1955 and 1961, that song was heard on ABC TV as actor Hugh O'Brien starred in The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp. Burt Lancaster, Kurt Russell, and Kevin Costner also portrayed Wyatt Earp over the years. One of the great figures from the American West, Earp has long been regarded as a brave frontier lawman, hero of the shootout at the OK Corral. But giving Earp a new look, historian Andrew Eisenberg paints a much more complex portrait of a man who seemed to alternate between wearing a badge and impulsive lawbreaking. Wyatt Earp, American vigilante, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Time for our second hour. Thank you again for tuning in.
Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame.
The actor Hugh O'Brien starred in The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp between 1955 and 1961 on ABC TV. Henry Fonda played Wyatt Earp in a 1946 John Ford film called My Darling Clementine. Burt Lancaster played Wyatt Earp in a 1957 movie, Gunfight at the OK Corral. And Wyatt Earp showed up in film twice in the 1990s in consecutive years. Kurt Russell played him in 1993's Tombstone. And Kevin Costner took the title role in 1994's Wyatt Earp. What we know or think we know about one of the great figures from the American West has been informed by pop culture for decades. The image of Wyatt Earp as the hero of the gunfight at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona Territory, on October 26, 1881, generally regarded as the most famous gunfight in the history of the American West, is at the core of the storytelling about Wyatt Earp. In his new book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, Andrew Eisenberg, a historian at Temple University, dismantles the myth of Earp and presents a more complex portrait of the man who spent most of his adult life bouncing between being a lawman and variously a thief, a brothel bouncer, a gambler, a confidence man. Andrew Eisenberg writes, "He donned and shucked off roles readily, whipsawing between lawman and lawbreaker, and pursued his changing ambitions recklessly, with little thought to the cost to himself, and still less thought to the cost, even the deadly cost, to others." Andrew Eisenberg, author of Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, published by Hill & Wang. We welcome you to Midday on WYPR in Baltimore.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on the program.
You're a historian of the American West, and it must be interesting to go through life as an actual historian of the American West, meeting so many people, so many Americans, whose ideas about the West and the stories and legends are informed by, Louis L'Amour, television shows, movies. Am I right? People must be
You've got it exactly right, yes. Most people I meet, students who come into my classes, their notions of the West are formed by Hollywood.
Yeah.
So absolutely. In fact, it's the same is true with Wyatt Earp. When I speak about Wyatt Earp, I ask people, where did you first hear about Wyatt Earp? And it's always one of the films. If they're younger, it's one of those films from the 90s. If they're a little bit older, it's that Hugh O'Brien TV series that you played the opening song.
And the words of which I remembered yesterday when we played it again. And Hugh O'Brien in a satiny kind of vest, always well-dressed.
Absolutely.
Was that the case with Wyatt Earp at that point in his life?
Wyatt Earp was widely described as someone who dressed well, who presented himself very well. He was, by all accounts, very handsome, and for his time, a very tall man. So that part, the story got right, the show got correct.
What brought you to a whole book, spending your time and scholarship on Wyatt Earp? Is it because of the movies, the way he's been depicted over time? You were curious about what was real and what wasn't?
Well, the reasons why I started the book turned out to be different from the reasons that I ended up writing the book. I have been lecturing and teaching about the American West for a long time, and I've been inserting a Wyatt Earp lecture into my course a lot, going back 15 years or so. And the students liked it and allowed me to show the films or little clips from the films. And since Wyatt Earp's life touched on so many things that are important in the social history of the 19th century West, brothels and cow towns and the mining camps, I could sort of use his life as a way to talk about these things. And so I was deluded into thinking that I could very quickly write up a kind of biography of Earp. I thought I knew most of what I knew about him. And I started going back to the original documents and found that they were at odds with my understanding of him, which had also partly been informed by Hollywood in a way that I hadn't really understood. And so I started looking more closely at the stories that he was telling about his life. I thought that I could sort out the truth from the things that were made up. And what I realized was the stories that Earp told about his own past, that was the central part of the story. The way he altered the things that had happened to him, the way he appropriated other people's actions as his own in order to justify some of the things he'd done, that was the central story.
Where does the story begin? Does it begin in Iowa or some other state? Because I get the impression that Wyatt Earp, who bounced around a lot of different places during his life, kind of started his life that way. His family was somewhat like that.
Yes. His family was on the move a lot, which is not unusual in the middle part of the 19th century. Americans were really mobile in a way that we don't always remember about 19th century Americans. And his father picked up from Illinois, moved to Iowa, then back to Illinois and back to Iowa, and this is all before Earp's 16th birthday. And then when Wyatt was in his teens, the family moved across the continent to California, and he was there until just before his 17th birthday. And then he picked up again and started moving around in the company of his brother as a freighter, working in the far west, going between California and Utah particularly. So he moved around a lot, and his family was, in addition to being on the move a lot geographically, they were also sort of downwardly mobile socially. His father kept looking for a foothold in society, and he never quite found it.
Did he find a job? What kind of career did his dad have?
His father was a saloon keeper, a bootlegger. He was elected to some minor public offices. He was a town constable. He was a justice of the peace. He ran a grocery store, but he didn't have what you would call a career. He was, you know, someone who also was a farmer, had grown up as a farmer. He would rent farms, raise crops, but he just bounced around from place to place and job to job. Mm-hmm.
Wyatt Earp was born in March 1848. That's, you know, 13 years before the Civil War. I'm just curious about the family's connection or relationship to that war, where they were during that time, if you know anything about his father, Nicholas, in the Civil War.
Well, his father found work as a deputy provost marshal in Iowa, which is where they were during the first 4 years of the war, which meant he was essentially one of those guys who made sure that soldiers who had deserted were returned to their units and that eventually people would comply with the Conscription Act, the draft. So that was a sort of unpopular job for someone to have. Three of Earp's older brothers served. His oldest half-brother, one of his older brothers, James, who was shot in one of the first skirmishes of the first battles of the war and was invalided out of the army almost immediately. But then his next oldest brother, Virgil, whom Wyatt really admired, served for almost the entire length of the war. And for someone of Wyatt Earp's generation who was just slightly too young to have served in the war, this put them in an awkward position in the post-war years, because in the years after the war, definitions of manhood in 19th century America became much more martial. It became much more about your ability to prove yourself in combat and courage. And a guy like Wyatt Earp had been slightly too young to serve, looked up to those older men, and particularly older brothers who had served and had had the chance to prove themselves. And this was something that I think bothered Earp when he became an adult himself, that he'd never had that opportunity.
I just want to make a note here. You've mentioned Virgil. You mentioned James. The ones that will figure into this story later on in life when we get out to Arizona territory, certainly Virgil. And who is another brother's name that we should note here?
There's a younger brother of Earp, Morgan.
Morgan.
Who's also in Tombstone. James is in Tombstone as well. And then later on, an even younger brother, Warren Earp, they all eventually congregate in Arizona.
Okay. You write in the book that Nicholas Earp's sons left home at their first opportunity, yet even then he cast a long shadow over them. Like him, they would lead lives of transience, conflict, and self-invention. So I guess we should pick up from there the story of Wyatt Earp. Once he leaves home, where does he go?
Well, he stays with his family in California, more or less. He's working as a freighter. But then he accompanies his father back to the Midwest. The family picks up and moves to Lamar, Missouri, which is in the southwestern corner of the state. Earp's father becomes the justice of the peace in the town, and Wyatt Earp is elected, first appointed and then elected, to be the town constable. And this is a sleepy little town. There's not a lot of crime going on. But the Earp family and the broader extended Earp family had, in a number of towns that they'd lived in, worked their way into one or both of these positions, because this allowed them to have an income while they would pursue other kinds of jobs as a way to make a living as well. And it was, you would arrest someone, and you were paid per arrest if you were the town constable, and then you'd bring them before the court, and the person presiding in the court would be the justice of the peace, one of your relatives, and you would be able to earn court costs this way. So this is a kind of what the sociologist Max Weber calls a municipal booty politics. It's a way to earn money through this. And the Earps, Nicholas's father and some of his brothers had done this in Illinois, and Nicholas and Virgil do this in California later on. And so this is one of the reasons why Earp is sort of drawn to police work, because you can earn these fees that way.
It's lucrative.
It's lucrative, yes.
Well, I'm trying to get my head around the idea of being paid per arrest.
Yeah, I mean, also, I mean, the town constable is also essentially the city dog catcher, and so he's paid 25 cents per dog, per stray dog that he rounds up. There's a lot of things like that. But Earp marries in Lamar, but his wife dies 10 months after they marry, and then he kind of goes off the rails. He leaves town, and as far as the town is concerned, he leaves without having returned some of the money he'd collected to build a local school. And a few months after that, he is arrested in what's now the state of Oklahoma, what was then Indian Territory, and he's charged with horse theft, and he's conveyed to a jail in Arkansas.
Well, now, there's a few things there. He raised money for a local school?
Yes. The local police officers were charged with collecting taxes as well, and they were allowed to keep a portion of the taxes they collected. This, I should say, is the big reason that Wyatt Earp, when he eventually finds his way to Arizona, wants to be elected county sheriff, because that was an extremely lucrative position. There was one major landholder in the county, the Southern Pacific Railroad. The county sheriff, by keeping a portion of those taxes, could count on a yearly income of about $30,000, which was an enormous amount in those days.
And one last question, if you don't mind, about the being paid per arrest. Would the constable just arrest whoever warranted being arrested, or would he arrest people maybe didn't warrant being arrested, or did he act on warrants? Was he looking for fugitives?
Well, there certainly is the temptation to simply arrest people on trumped-up charges and then bring them into the court, and you're still going to get the court costs for doing this. In fact, when Earp is arrested in Indian Territory for horse theft, he may have been guilty of this crime. We don't really know, but the U.S. deputy marshals who policed the Indian Territory were notorious for arresting people on trumped-up charges, particularly Native Americans on trumped-up charges, and then bringing them to the federal court. And in the event, they'd be in jail for a while, and the court the charges would be dismissed. But, you know, they would still be paid for their expenses, having rounded them up and paid per arrest. And so the temptation is certainly there.
We're talking about Wyatt Earp in this hour of the show, a new biography from our guest in this hour, Andrew Eisenberg, who's a historian at Temple University. This book is called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, published by Hill & Wang, which is an imprint of FSG. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and pick up the Wyatt Earp story after his being charged with horse thievery. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, the name of Andrew Eisenberg's book. How old was he when he was charged with the horse theft, the thievery you mentioned?
Gosh, he would have been 23 years old.
Yeah. What happened to that charge?
He escaped from jail. He and several other men, they were imprisoned in a kind of makeshift, falling apart, decrepit jail that the court was going to move from that building to another one shortly. And Earp made his escape and fled to Illinois.
So, Andrew Eisenberg, you're getting the taste here of Wyatt Earp early in life. He's drawn to the law, but really drawn to the law because it's a lucrative practice in those days. And then he gets charged with a couple of things. Well, he gets charged with a horse theft, and it looks like maybe he absconded with some money that was due to build a school. Mm-hmm. So what are we getting? We're getting a sense of a conflicted young man here.
We're getting a sense of a young man who is impulsive and who's drawn to petty crime.
Okay. Where does he go from there?
He goes to Peoria, Illinois. His brother Virgil is there, and he's later joined by his brother Morgan. And his brother Virgil is working as a bartender. Wyatt and Morgan both find work there as brothel bouncers. Earp is arrested three times in Peoria in 1872, and he's charged each time with consorting with prostitutes. But he's not really a customer of the prostitutes. He's a Confederate. He's working there.
Yeah, I mean, how do we know all this, by the way? Did Wyatt Earp keep a diary?
We know of these things from the court records in Indian Territory and from local newspaper accounts, the things that I've talked about thus far. He was, you know, when he's arrested for consorting with prostitutes, that appears in the local newspaper.
Okay. And so the brothers are sort of on this side of things, too, the dark side of things, I suppose.
Yes. You know, they also seem to be drawn into this kind of way of making a living as well.
Well, I guess maybe they thought somebody had to do it.
Well, that could be. I mean, there are a lot of ways you can sort of explain it by looking at the context of the times. One of the things is that, I mean, Virgil had served in the Army. He spent most of that time with the 83rd Illinois, stationed in Nashville, Tennessee. And Nashville was notorious for being a place that was just teeming with prostitutes during the war. And, you know, any man who served in the Civil War during this period would have obviously come into contact with prostitution. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways historians try to explain the sort of increasing notoriety of prostitution after the war is the result of the war. And less so in Peoria, but clearly when they moved to places like Wichita and Dodge City and Tombstone, those are cow towns and mining camps. They're dominated by young men. And so prostitutes are drawn there because there's a demand for their labor. So there's a number of reasons why they end up bumping into this way of making a living.
Mm-hmm. This is very interesting when you contrast it with the popular culture depictions of Wyatt Earp that I mentioned, we discussed at the very beginning of the show a few minutes ago. You know, I'm not sure Hugh O'Brien ever, playing Wyatt Earp on TV, ever gave up his past as a brothel bouncer.
Not in the episodes I ever saw.
No, same here. And then I can't speak to the Costner film or the one with Kurt Russell, Tombstone. But do we get from those depictions, those films from the 90s, this conflict within the man, this complexity?
You get a few more gestures in the films in the 90s toward Earp's sort of misspent youth. The horse theft shows up in the Costner film, as I remember it, and there's some oblique references to the prostitution in the Tombstone film with Kurt Russell.
Right. And we expect, I don't know where we expect it from, our idea of frontier justice, that that you're going to have some rough and ready men involved in frontier justice who are going to be on the margins of the law themselves, those who are set out to enforce it because they're going to be dealing with some very violent people. So Americans kind of, expect a little bit of that in these stories?
Well, I think that for the most part, popular culture, which, you know, in their understanding, its understanding of ERP, has been able to integrate this sort of earlier misspent youth into their way of thinking about ERP. It's just another way of thinking about him as a kind of rough and tumble kind of character who, you know, could cross over into the other side of the law, at least as a young man. Popular culture is less interested in thinking about him post-Tombstone, having continued this kind of behavior, but he did. So if you look at the, you know, whole period of his life, looking, you know, from the, you know, young adulthood well into his 60s, he was still engaged in these kinds of things. He never really repented of it. The Costner film casts him as sort of repenting of his earlier sins and really adhering to the law after that, and that's not how it was.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrew Eisenberg about his book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Let's stop in Dodge City for a minute in this story. I want to ask you about this. What was the Dodge City Peace Commission?
Oh, Dodge City Peace Commission is, that's 1883. This is after Tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand about Wyatt Earp. He was really only an amateur police officer. He was a police officer only occasionally. If you added up, maybe 5 years out of his life was the entire amount of time he served as a police officer, never more than 1 year at a time. But he was a professional gambler. That's how he made his living. He dealt cards. He dealt them very well. He was dealing a game called Faro, which was very popular in the 19th century West. It was widely reputed to be a game you only went into if you wanted to get cheated. It was the three-card Monte of the 19th century. And gamblers belonged to sort of fraternities. They worked as teams. There are two main groups in the 19th century West, the Easterners and the Slopers from the Pacific Slope. And Earp was an Easterner, and these guys protected their territory. And essentially what happened in Tombstone is that a friend of Earp's, Luke Short, his saloon where he controlled the faro tables, he was being muscled out by some other guys, and so Earp and some other Easterners showed up to make a show of force and basically make sure that this territory was protected. That's what it was about. And that happened in Tombstone as well. This is the way these guys operated.
Hmm. I, as a historian of the West, I want to ask you this question before we move on to Arizona. How bad was it? I mean, we have this idea that there are all these outlaws all the time, you know, stealing horses, robbing whatever banks there were out there or stores, causing all kinds of havoc all the time, well out of the control of marshals. I mean, just how bad and violent was it compared to what we've come to believe? Every Western depicts violence. I mean, was it that bad? Was it as common?
It's hard for me to answer, was it that bad or was it that common? I can say, here's the kind of situation you're dealing with. Earp was in Wichita, Kansas for 2 years. He was a policeman there. And in one of those years, there was one murder. And because Wichita only had 1,200 people, the murder rate in Wichita that year was, you know, it was one of the most dangerous places in the country. And the next year, there was no murder, which made it the safest place in the country. And these places were so small, mm-hmm. So when violence happened, and they only served as, especially these mining camps, when the ore plays out, everybody leaves. So they're not around for very long. It's very hard to get a kind of statistical sense of how violent they actually were.
Mm-hmm.
I can say what's not true is the kind of thing that's usually depicted in Hollywood films. And this is also the case in the Tombstone film with Kevin Costner, where the bad guys are a gang who all wear red sashes around their waists. The violence was not organized. The violence that occurred was happening because of drunkenness and impeded desire and thwarted affection and a kind of honor culture among young men that came from the Texas Cowboys that, you know, any insult had to be met with violence. So that's the kind of thing that's creating most of the violence that's happening. It's not a sort of organized or highly criminal kind of violence.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not – people aren't – Yeah.
I want to step back a little bit from the Wild West and before we get out to Arizona, this part of Wyatt Earp's life where he serves as a referee in a heavyweight fight, that's not something I expected to see in this biography, but please tell us that story.
Well, that is one of the most important parts of Wyatt Earp's life, because this happens in 1896. It's in San Francisco. Earp has spent the previous 8 or 9 years living in California. He's a boxing promoter, and he trains and races horses. And Tombstone and the vigilante killings that followed the Tombstone gunfight has been largely forgotten. Earp was briefly a celebrity because of it, but it's been forgotten for the most part. And he's known at that point in California as a kind of boxing guy, as a horse racing guy. And that fight in 1896 was widely reputed to have been fixed, that the underdog won. He won because the referee called a foul on the man who was favored to win, said he punched the underdog below the belt and, you know, called a foul, awarded the fight to the underdog as he was being carried out of the ring, having been knocked out. And the referee was Wyatt Earp. And everybody at the time thought that Wyatt Earp was in on the fix. And given his past as a gambler, as a confidence man, as someone who was involved in boxing and horse racing, both of which had these associations with fixed matches and races and gambling, it all kind of makes sense. And everyone who was associated with the fight kind of agreed that that was going on. And Earp finds himself all of a sudden with this incredibly negative celebrity. And people start asking, who is this guy? And all the stories about Tombstone and his involvement as a vigilante get dredged up because of that. So the 1896 fight is crucial, because without that, we may well have just forgotten about Wyatt Earp and the O.K. Corral fight, that it just wouldn't have become part of popular culture. But after that 1896 heavyweight prize fight, Earp sets about trying to restore his reputation. And so that's what led to the popular icon that we have now, is Earp's efforts to rebuild his reputation.
Well, we're going to take a little break and then come back to the story of Wyatt Earp and the central story of his life, the one that occurred before this in Tombstone, Arizona, and the gunfight at the O.K. Corral, with Andrew Eisenberg, author of a new biography, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. This is Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. Wyatt Earp of the 19th century American West was not the film icon familiar to modern Americans. While the Hollywood version is stubbornly, consistently duty-bound, in actuality, Wyatt led a life of restlessness, inconstancy, impulsive law-breaking, and shifting identities. Beginning in his late teens, he rarely lived more than a year or two in one place. For much of his life, he was both hunter and hunted. He was a lawman in Missouri, Kansas, and Arizona. He was also a fugitive in Colorado and saw the inside of jails in Arkansas, Illinois, Arizona, and California. He also spent most of his life working in brothels, saloons, and gambling halls. When he was not wearing a badge, he was variously a thief, brothel bouncer, professional gambler, and confidence man who specialized in selling gold bricks that were nothing more than rocks painted yellow. From Andrew Eisenberg's book, Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Good stuff there, Andrew. Now, if you don't mind, we'll step back a few years, because we jumped around a little bit there. And I want to end up in Tombstone, Arizona in 1881, right? That's October.
Yes.
Take us back a few years before that and lead us there. How does Wyatt Earp end up in the Arizona Territory?
Well, Earp has been in Dodge City, Kansas, since 1876, and his habit is to work as a police officer during the cattle drive season, which is summer and fall, and then he will resign his position at the end of the fall, and he'll head south, and he'll work the Southern Plains and Texas gambling circuit, and that's also where, in Texas in 1878, he is apprehended for selling a gold brick. That's not a gold brick, it's just a rock painted yellow.
Right.
So these faro dealing can slip into confidence games as well. And in 1879, when he resigns his position, he moves all the way down to Tombstone, because silver has been discovered in Tombstone. It's the latest boom town for mining. And his brother, Virgil, has been living in Prescott, Arizona for a few years, and Virgil also wants to go to Tombstone, and there's a lot of money to be made down there. And when Earp gets there, after being there for a short while, he is interested in becoming the sheriff of a new county that's being created with Tombstone as the county seat, Cochise County. And as I said earlier, this would be an extremely lucrative position, much, much more lucrative than any of the local police offices that he's held previously. This would mean keeping a portion of the taxes you've collected, about $30,000 a year, a really enormous amount. This would be the biggest booty politics that he's ever played before. But he's not politically connected. There are other guys who are much more politically connected, so he's not initially appointed to this position, but he really wants to be elected to it. So he figures that the way to get elected would be to apprehend some local stage robbers. There's so much silver coming out of the ground, and there's no rail connection directly to Tombstone. It has to go to another city 10 or 15 miles away. And so it's brought there by stagecoach, and so there are some stage robbers who have been going after stagecoaches. So Earp figures the way to apprehend these guys would be to lure them to a ranch where there are some local ranchers. And these local ranchers are involved in rustling cattle in Mexico, but they're not really hardened criminals by any stretch of the imagination. But Earp is going to deal with these cowboys, and he's going to have them talk to the stage robbers, lure them to the ranch, and there Earp will arrest them. The cowboys can keep the reward that Wells Fargo has put out for them, and Earp will get the glory for capturing them and be elected to the county sheriff. This is the scheme that Earp cooks up. And this leads to the gunfight because the cowboys with whom Earp has schemed become afraid that Earp has revealed their complicity and that these cowboys are then in danger for their lives or at least their reputation because they will be known as snitches. And so the gunfight, which is played out in all the Hollywood films as a fight between police officers and hardened criminals, is actually a gunfight between police officers and their disaffected informants. It's between the snitches and Earp and his brothers and Doc Holliday.
We're talking about Billy Claiborne, right?
Billy Claiborne flees as soon as the shooting begins.
Okay, but the main characters in this story.
The main characters are Ike Clanton, Billy Clanton, Tom McClory, and Frank McClory.
Okay, those four. Billy Claiborne, the first one I mentioned.
Billy Claiborne is there at the beginning and very quickly retires from the.
Okay, so I mean, you make it sound like a political stunt to some degree.
Yes.
Yes.
I think that's a good way to understand it.
You're convinced. So I wonder, I mean, all the stories we've heard over the years is that, well, I can't really say why. What did I know about it? I know these were bad guys. And I think the way it's been depicted in film is that Wyatt Earp was already a marshal or a deputy marshal, right? I think that's suggested in a lot of the pop culture depictions of this.
Virgil was a deputy United States Marshal.
Oh, Virgil was. He had a badge.
And shortly before the gunfight, Virgil had been elevated to being town marshal because the man who was elected to be town marshal had simply left town. And so then Wyatt and Doc Holliday and Morgan Earp as well are all appointed to be Wyatt's deputies to deal with this situation at outside of the OK Corral, in an empty lot behind the OK Corral, which is where the gunfight actually happens.
Right. It didn't actually happen in the corral.
It started in the assembly lot and then spilled out into the street.
Right. Boy, there's a lot of myths being busted here. Okay. But he was – Wyatt Earp, you got to say, is a pretty savvy guy, right? Because if this scheme, as you describe it, was in his mind, he wanted to be sheriff of the new Cochise County – it would certainly make him a hero, right?
He was savvy. He was a smart guy. He wasn't well-educated, but he was a smart man. I will say that this was sort of like the longest con, the biggest scheme that he'd ever attempted. I mean, selling a rock painted yellow as a gold brick, you're leaving town as soon as you've played that con, right?
Right.
Because that's going to be discovered. And the same thing with dealing faro. This is why Wyatt Earp spends much of his life after Tombstone moving from one town to another, usually one mining camp to another, never more than a year or so at a time, because this kind of life, you can't stay in one place for a long time. You're going to be found out, your reputation's going to be, and then you're gone. So this was the kind of longest scheme and a sort of plan maybe for a little bit more permanence in Tombstone.
We're in Tombstone, Arizona territory with Andrew Eisenberg, author of Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life, and we're at the, it's October 26th, right, 1881?
Mm-hmm, you've got it right.
Okay, now, why do the Clanton boys, Ike and Billy, and the McLaurys, Tom and Frank, why do they go to, how are they lured there? How does Wyatt get them there?
They actually had come to town the previous night to confront Wyatt Earp about their believing that he had revealed this conspiracy. And the whole group, not Wyatt, but Virgil and Ike Clanton and some other guys, spend the whole night playing poker. And Ike gets drunker and drunker. And then the next morning, Ike kind of decides that he's going to make at least a public demonstration of bravado and a kind of anti-Earp animus. And so he goes out on a street corner armed and declares he's going to shoot down the Earps, and Virgil comes and arrests him. And then one of the McClory brothers shows up, and a similar kind of... So my sense is that when the McClory and Clanton brothers are down at this empty lot, which is sort of on the edge of town, and they seem to be thinking about leaving town, they've been kind of making a public demonstration all day, a display of courage. Nobody's now going to think that they're in cahoots with the Earps, because clearly the whole town has seen that they hate them. And the Earps decide, well, they're armed, we're going to go down there and disarm them. I don't think anyone is expecting that this is going to lead to shooting. This is just a kind of back-and-forth posturing that went on.
Mm-hmm. And is it true that when the conflict or the shooting started, some of these men were only a few feet apart, that they were actually having a conversation?
That's absolutely right.
Is that true?
Well, there wasn't much of a conversation before the shooting started, but that's absolutely right. They were only standing a few feet apart.
All right, this is the gun.
And the shootout lasted 30 seconds.
30 seconds. And just to make sure we get all the characters here, we've got Virgil Earp, Wyatt Earp, who is, would you call him a temporary lawman at that point?
Yeah, he's a deputy police officer.
Anyone assisting
the marshal is a deputy.
Okay. And then is there Assistant Town Marshal Morgan?
Yes, he's also deputy police officer. And then Doc Holliday, who was not formally deputized, but again, he's helping the town marshal, so no one's going to really question that.
Okay, so Morgan Earp is there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Doc...
So it's the three Earp brothers and Doc Holliday.
Doc Holliday.
Yes.
See, some of this I remember from television and the movies before I read your book, Andrew. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So the shooting starts, and can you tell us what happened in the shooting?
Well, it's a short story, right?
Yeah, it's 30 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah, both McClory's and Billy Clanton are killed. Wyatt is not scratched. Doc Holliday is nicked in the hip with a bullet. Virgil and Morgan are both hit. Virgil is shot in the calf. Morgan, he was standing sideways when he's shooting, you know, it's sort of a duelist's stance. He's shot in the shoulder, and the bullet passes through both shoulders, chips his sort of vertebrae on its way out. So he's the most seriously injured of the Earps. But they all survive.
Do we know for sure that the main character of your book, Wyatt Earp, fired his weapon?
Yes.
Does he claim to have killed one of the others?
Yes, he claims to have drawn when he saw Frank McClory draw his weapon and shoot Frank McClory, who was reputed to be the one they had to worry about the most.
Okay.
Ike Clanton was probably not armed. Tom, and he was the one who was not killed on the other side. Tom McClory may not have been armed, but may have been reaching for a rifle that was in the scabbard of a saddle of a horse that was nearby. There are disputing accounts. The thing that we have to remember is that after this gunfight, this is something that I don't think has ever showed up in one of those Hollywood films. The Earps were conveyed to court, and Virgil and Morgan were, you know, lying in bed, but Wyatt and Doc Holliday spent about 3 weeks in jail while a court proceeding was going on. It was an inquest or a hearing to determine whether or not they should go to trial for murder, because the Cowboys, Ike Clanton and his friends, brought charges against these guys. And the court decided there weren't sufficient charges to go to trial for murder. But at the same time, a lot of things came out. Wyatt Earp probably had his gun either in his hand or in his coat pocket as he was approaching, and he was one of the first people to fire, may have been the first person to fire.
The gunfight at the OK Corral, that phrase, did that become well known immediately? Of course, there were newspapers all over the country in this year, 1881. Did this hit the press within a week or two?
Yeah, it was national news briefly. Now that you ask the question, I'm not sure that it was ever called the gunfight at the OK Corral at that time. I think that came later. But
I was going to ask you about that, Andrew, because it's important to mention at some point here, Stuart Lake. Stuart Lake's his book, Frontier Marshal. Now I'm pushing this up to the 20th century now. This is like, what, the 1930s when this book comes out, right?
It's published in 1931.
I'm just curious, is he the one who coined that phrase? Is that how the gunfight really became popular because of that book? That was my question.
The gunfight and Wyatt Earp as a national icon, that's started by Lake's biography in 1931. But if I have anything to say about Wyatt Earp that's different from what people have said before, we've all known that Hollywood has created all sorts of notions about Wyatt Earp and that Stuart Lake created all sorts of myths about Wyatt Earp. One of the things I want to make clear is that a lot of the essential myths about Wyatt Earp were created by Earp himself, that after that 1896 heavyweight prize fight that we talked about earlier that created so much negative celebrity for Earp, he really started sulking. I mean, he was upset by this negative celebrity that he had, and he kind of went into hiding. Because earlier in his life, when he lived in an America where he could pick up and move to a new town and nobody knew him, he could get away with telling stories about himself. But now there was this national media culture. He couldn't get away with that anymore, and he really resented that. And he found himself in the teens living in Los Angeles, only a few miles away from the Hollywood studios, and he decided at some point that he was going to use this new media culture to remake his life. So he goes to Hollywood. He befriends early silent film Western stars. He regales them with made-up stories about his life. They love him. And he starts dictating his memoirs and tweaking and editing and reshaping what had really happened and making himself into this icon of Law and Order in this effort to remake his reputation and see his life on film. And he tries a couple times. There are two memoirs he dictates. Neither of them are published for whatever reason. He finally lands with Stuart Lake, who's an aspiring screenwriter. And Lake becomes he's the conduit for Earp stories. He figures out what Earp is trying to do here, and he helps him craft this Law and Order martial identity.
Oh, and I bet Hollywood craved it, loved it.
Well, of course they did, and Earp is sort of casting it in a way that it will be acceptable to Hollywood. That's what he's trying to do.
A shrewd and savvy man, for sure, just based on that story. I want to go back to 1880s again. So after the shootout at Tombstone, that's October. We need to go to December. Because of what this part of the story involves Virgil and Morgan.
The Cowboys brought the Earps to trial, or they tried to bring them to trial. That didn't work. They're still upset. They feel that the killings were totally unjustified, and they take their vengeance against Virgil in December. They shotgun him on a street when he's alone on the street. He survives, but he's crippled. He loses the use of one arm. And then in March 1882, they kill Morgan Earp. They shoot him from behind as he's shooting pool in a billiards hall. And Wyatt Earp is nearby as that's happening. And so he watches his brother die. And after that, Wyatt snaps. And he, after the shooting of Virgil, he had secured for himself a deputy United States Marshal commission. And he'd already assembled a posse to try and find the guys who had shot Virgil. And that posse goes into action. And in the space of a little more than a week, that posse with Wyatt Earp leading it kills two guys for sure that he believes are part of Morgan's assassination, and maybe a third person as well.
You describe really in the front of the book there, an eye for an eye, the night of March 20th, 1882, at a train station in Tucson.
Yes, that's Wyatt and his posse go up to Tucson. They're actually accompanying the body of Morgan as it's going to be put on the train in Tucson and shipped to Southern California for burial. And one of the men whom Wyatt holds responsible, a man named Frank Stillwell, who was a deputy sheriff, another corrupt law officer in Cochise County, probably a stage robber as well, was in Tucson because he had to actually be in court for something else. He was accused of stage robbery. And Earp and his posse go up, and essentially it's a summary execution. Stillwell is shot several times. His own pistol is not fired.
Mm. When I read that and I read this aspect of Wyatt Earp's life and his vigilantism, which, of course, is why you have the subtitle in your book, I think of the character from True Grit, Rooster Cogburn, especially portrayed by Jeff Bridges in the Coen Brothers version. There's a scene where he's in court and he's asked how many men he's killed. The suggestion being he's killed a lot of men without giving them a chance to return for a trial. And I think, you know, that's part of what this story is it not, that this the frontier justice, the vigilante as an American icon, the law is not always good enough. Sometimes you have to take the law into your own hands.
Well, that's the central part of his myth. Yeah. That is what makes him such a celebrity, so attractive to a lot of people now, because he seems to justify this idea that the courts are corrupt. You're never going to find justice in the courts. So the only way you're going to find justice is essentially by getting a gun and imposing it yourself violently.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of extra legal justice is what Earp has come to symbolize. And in fact, when Stuart Lake wrote his first biography, which is one of the reasons I find Stuart Lake so important in the making of the Earp mythology, he really cast Wyatt Earp as a kind of Elliot Ness of the Old West.
Mm-hmm.
He makes all the cowboys into a kind of, Al Capone gang. And you know, Wyatt is this intrepid FBI man. And so, you know, this is the 1930s, and when these mafia guys are at the height of their celebrity, and he kind of casts Wyatt Earp in that way. So from the very beginning, he's been a symbol of extra legal justice. When your enemies are so bad and the courts are unreliable, you just have to get a gun and take the law into your own hands. That's the myth.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a myth. There's echoes of it today in society today. I think of the president or the CEO of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Absolutely, and Wyatt Earp is the quintessential, in mythology, good guy with a gun. And what I'm trying to do here, in part, by complexifying him in this biography, is to show that it's just not that simple. That he was, in 1882, when he went on this vigilante ride, he was really bent on vengeance. And the idea that he had to impose this kind of justice because the courts were unreliable and so forth, that was a justification that only came much, much later. And it came when he was in Hollywood, when he was in Los Angeles, when he was talking to these Hollywood guys. And it also came in part because in the early years of the 20th century, he came across a copy of this novel, The Virginian, by Owen Wister, which, I don't know if you know the novel, but it's very famous. It has a scene of vigilante justice in it. And it's, you know, it was only after reading that book that the justification for his vigilantism came to Wyatt Earp. It was only after that point that he said, you know, I had to do this because the courts were unreliable and this is how it was in the Old West. Before that, he'd never tried to justify it as anything other than, well, to the extent that it was justified at all, it was just vengeance. They killed my brother, I killed them.
Mm-hmm. Wyatt Earp lived until when, Andrew? The 1920s sometime or?
January 29, yes.
1929. So yeah. That's before the publication of Lake's book about him.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And he talked to Stuart Lake a few times, but mm-hmm. he died before it was published.
And do you think, who embellished? I guess that's a little bit of a mystery, maybe. I don't know, maybe not for you. You're the historian. Did Lake embellish, or did Wyatt Earp embellish in telling the story to Lake?
Well, they both embellished, and there are some things that Lake clearly added to the story. Lake, you know, found holes in Wyatt Earp's life, and he filled them in using mm-hmm. his own imagination. And Lake added this kind of the sort of Elliot Ness, Al Capone sort of tweak on Tombstone. That's clearly coming from Lake as well. And Lake, who was a stalwart Republican, made Wyatt Earp into a Republican as well, which is
sort
of amusing to me.
I agree very much.
But, you know, Earp dictated his life story twice before, and those are two unpublished manuscripts. And you go look at those. One of those Lake had access to, but the other one apparently he did not. So when you find things that are in those two unpublished things, you know it's coming from Earp and not from Lake.
Listen, this is coming from Eisenberg now, not Lake. Thank you very much, Andrew. Really enjoyed the conversation and the book.
Thanks for having me. Yep. I appreciate it.
The book, again, Wyatt Earp, of a Vigilante Life, published by Hill & Wang. We've been speaking with Andrew Eisenberg, the author, a historian at Temple University.
Midday is produced by Nikki Gamer and Sean Yost. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. The director and engineer is John Ahrens. Our interns are Rachel Schultes, Megumi Kiwamoto, Abigail Pedroni, Zachary Gooding, Jacob Siegel, and Jason Van Slyke. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station. Thank you.